that sign, raise a flag with the guiding star, and sing a song of freedom with joy. For peace, liberty, and justice shall forevermore reign. So Lord bless our Sudan, so Lord bless our Sudan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Rebecca Hamilton. She's an author and journalist who recently returned from Sudan. She was there as a special correspondent on Sudan for the Washington Post and as a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action in the Struggle to Stop Genocide, came out earlier this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Hamilton.
Thank you.
And you saw the flag go up today at the United Nations for this new country, South Sudan. I take it yesterday you were also in the UN Security Council.
Yes, I watched the UN Security Council meeting yesterday where all of the members on the council decided that they would be recommending to the General Assembly to admit this new nation of South Sudan into the community of the United Nations, and that's exactly what happened today.
But I guess the hallowed halls of the United Nations is a different place from what's happening there on the ground. And when we spoke fairly recently, you were in the disputed area of Abyei, where there was considerable fighting. What's the latest in terms of the reality on the ground as opposed to all of the pomp and ceremony surrounding the admission of a new country to the United Nations?
I have to say it was quite surreal for me yesterday sitting at the UN and hearing them refer to places that I have been speaking to people who've been displaced from lately, like Abyei, like Southern Kordofan, and just a very, very different world, this sort of clean, air-conditioned environment where everybody's speaking politely. It feels very far removed from the realities on the ground. So there's two situations to update on. The first is Abyei, which is a contested area between North and South Sudan that the government, the Sudanese government in the North, seized back in May and displaced 100,000 people as a consequence. Those 100,000 people all fled into the South, and that, for the most part, is where they remain. The Sudanese government is still occupying the Abyei area, and so it is not safe for people to return. They're living in very, very difficult humanitarian conditions. There has been a fuel shortage in the south because of a blockade by the government in the north that has made it very difficult to get relief supplies to those people in the south, plus it's the rainy season. So you have a difficult humanitarian situation in the south as a consequence of Abyei. And then the new development that we've had over the last month is what's happening in Southern Kordofan. And Southern Kordofan is in the northern state, in what is now called Sudan, separate from South Sudan. And what is happening there, has been happening for the last month and continues to happen today, is that the Sudanese government is relentlessly dropping bombs in that area. Now, it's saying that it is doing this to, quote-unquote, cleanse the area of rebel elements. It's absolutely true that there are people in the area who fought with the South, in fact, in the long civil war. But as they drop the bombs, they're also falling on civilians. And we've seen incredible footage, the first really comprehensive video footage put together by Al Jazeera, who managed to get in illegally, has just come out today, really showing the harm that that is causing to civilians who are inside northern Sudan.
Well, Rebecca Hamilton, as you know, George Clooney has taken a considerable interest in Sudan and in Darfur, and he has organized the Satellite Sentinel project. And there are satellite images apparently showing mass graves in this area that you just spoke about. What do you know about that?
I've just read the reporting the same as everybody else on that. We had heard these allegations of mass graves, and I have heard them from people that I've been speaking to on Skype are in Southern Kordofan, but I've only been able to get so far secondhand reports of the existence of these mass graves. Now, what the satellite imagery purports to show are images of mass graves. I mean, I have to say, as someone who doesn't know enough about the satellite imagery, it's difficult for me to really make sense of what I'm seeing. But the analysts at the Satellite Sentinel Project have looked at it, and it is their belief that this is an indication of mass graves. What we don't have and what we desperately need is really comprehensive on-the-ground testimony that can explain what happened to get to the point where there are these alleged mass graves in the ground. And the reason that we don't have that information is that the Sudanese government is systematically blocking any outsiders from going in and conducting investigations. And it's not only that they're stopping journalists and human rights organizations from getting in there and really working out what's going on. But they're also stopping humanitarian organizations. And we know without question that so many of the civilians are having to flee into the mountains to try to escape these bombings. With no humanitarian services there for them, we're looking at a secondary humanitarian crisis that follows the death and destruction that is coming from the direct violence of the bombing.
And again, I'm speaking with author and journalist Rebecca Hamilton, who's just recently returned from Sudan and has witnessed the UN Security Council admitting this new country into the Community of Nations, and the flag, of course, being raised at the UN of the new country of South Sudan. The government, of course, of General Omar Bashir has denied that they are bombing the Nuba Mountains and in the South Kordofan area, but he also appeared before his parliament. Now, how does he explain the loss of one-third of his country? And if you look at the map, of course, the north that Bashir now has left, the Republic of Sudan is largely desert except for the Nile Valley, but the south is very green and, you know, with lots of grassland and tropical forest. So how does he explain to his people that they've lost the, you know, not a, by the way, that's also the south where the oil is. So I'm just wondering how he's basically saying everything is fine and we're all going to get along. Meanwhile, he's bombing people. But what about the sense of bitterness in the north that they've lost this jewel?
Yes, President Bashir is in a very difficult position domestically right now because there are a number of northerners who do blame him for having taken power over a united Sudan and having presided over the loss of the most oil-rich part of the country. And I think part of what we're seeing with him sending the army into these areas, into Abyei, into southern Kordofan, is a very, very old tactic. There's nothing like being able to rally domestic support by the construction of a sort of external enemy. And that's what he's saying in southern Kordofan. He's saying that the people that are there, they're rebels, they're enemies of the state, they're trying to overthrow us. We need to mobilize against them. And I think as much as it is an issue that they're concerned that there are rebels there, and they have every right to be concerned about that, but the way to go about it is not to just be bombing wholesale with the enormous civilian casualties that come along with it. It's to actually address the political, underlying political causes that have led people in the Nuba Mountains to have to take up arms over the years to fight for the right to their own identity and to fight for many of the things that, frankly, people in southern Sudan were fighting for, which is the right to be first-class citizens in their own country. And it's the same story of wanting to be first-class citizens in Sudan that you're seeing in the Nuba Mountains, but that you are also have been seeing over the years in Darfur.
Well, it's worth noting here, though, surely, Rebecca Hamilton, that the head of the rest of Sudan, General Omar Bashir, has had a International Criminal Court arrest warrant issued for crimes against humanity during the Darfur 8-year massacres there. There's also an arrest warrant for Ahmed Haroun, who the former Darfur governor, who is now the governor of the area we're talking about that's being bombed, South Kordofan.
Yes, he was formerly in Darfur as, would you believe, working in the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs. In fact, but you're right, he is now the governor of southern Kordofan, an election that was contested. The results are disputed by many of the Nuba people who live in the southern Kordofan area who were supporting a different candidate. So, yes, you have these same players, Omar al-Bashir, Ahmed Haroun, and the rest of the ruling National Congress Party, who have been there throughout what happened in Darfur and are still in power today. And I think that's, you know, one of the things about what we've seen, all these efforts on Darfur over the years, is that fundamentally, at the end of the day, the people who are most responsible for the atrocities that happened there have remained in power. And it's pretty much the same set of factors that are driving these new conflicts in different parts of the North. And the question, I think, sort of at the back of everybody's minds is, how viable is this new state of Sudan in the North? Is it going to be able to hold these different sections on the periphery together if it doesn't address their political grievances? Back to this core question of, is everybody going to be an equal citizen in this new northern country of Sudan?
And is there any kind of stirrings of the Arab Spring to add to Bashir's woes?
There has been a little bit, and certainly when you saw the initial uprisings, there was quite a lot of excitement among the youth, I would say, in particular, and particularly in Khartoum, in the capital, that maybe this was going to spread over. What they found was that they couldn't really get traction to make it a mainstream enough protest project to really make a difference. What could change with that, though, is the problems that the northern economy is going to be facing now. For a long time, the government in the north has managed to keep a segment of Sudanese society relatively comfortable through a patronage system, and it's been able to do that in recent years because of the huge amount of oil wealth. Now, with 80% of Sudan's oil reserves today now belonging to the new country of South Sudan, the northern economy is in a much more difficult state. And if that does start to affect people's daily lives, then I think the risk of popular protests for Bashir's against Bashir's government do drastically increase.
And of course, if the new country of South Sudan decides to build pipelines through Kenya and Ethiopia to the Indian Ocean, that would put the North out of business altogether in that regard. I thank you for joining us, Rebecca Hamilton.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who's an author and journalist. She's recently returned from Sudan. She was there as a special correspondent on Sudan for the Washington Post and as a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, came out earlier this year. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who served throughout the entire Clinton administration as Secretary of Labor and longer than anybody else. And has become one of the more trenchant critics of the, well, particularly of the Republicans, but he's also, in this case, in our conversation, obviously very critical and very disappointed in the president. And he's negotiating style and he's negotiating strategy, which is frankly baffling. And particularly when you consider that the president's giving away $3 for every dollar he gets back in tax breaks from the Republicans, which they then reneged on. So we were kind of puzzling about trying to figure out what the president put on the table and whether it's still on the table, whether he's still prepared to give away the store in terms of Social Security and Medicaid, not to mention whatever else they agreed to. So it's a very dismal situation, and we try to also analyze what the real leverage is that the president has, since both sides are playing brinksmanship. If the president is trying to get the Republicans, basically trying to nail them with they're the irresponsible ideologues who not just shut down the American government like Newt Gingrich is, but destroyed the full faith and credit of the United States and causing interest rates to rise and nobody gets their Social Security checks, et cetera, et cetera. It's a massive catastrophe if this bluff is called. So the question is, if the Republicans are held responsible for it, it's a Pyrrhic victory for the president because he still ends up with a completely screwed up economy, and yet which he has to deal with for a whole year, ending, of course, with a resounding defeat in 2012, to be sure. So that's the sort of, obviously Robert Reich seems to think they're going to make some kind of deal. But who knows? At this point, it truly is a disgraceful situation and an alternative universe where all of those people who have jobs in Washington are just playing these irresponsible games like petulant teenagers, while there's real harm and hurt out in the United States. We followed the conversation with Robert Reich with Jeff Madrick, the author of a new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. Kind of says it all, doesn't it? And that was a very interesting discussion. I thought we learned quite a bit from him. and he is has looked into the systemic nature of why these crises happen time and time again, and of course they get worse, and nothing was worse than the last one in 2008. And he thinks that we're going to basically have a long, long period, at least a decade-long period of stagnation, high unemployment, and a lot of the standard of living and quality of life of seniors, young, and poor and vulnerable people are going to be adversely affected. In short, the rich will be living in their gated communities, and the rest of us will be, you know, living in this kind of third world, scrabbling without much hope that things are going to get better. So maybe it's a permanent condition. Then finally, we talked to Rebecca Hamilton, who's just back from South Sudan today. South Sudan became the 193rd nation to be admitted into the United Nations, amid all kinds of pomp and ceremony on the UN Security Council. But she talked about the reality on the ground back in Sudan, where she just returned from the front, where there's a war going on in the border area. They're bombing the hell out of the Nuba tribe in the mountain. And now George Clooney's people have satellite evidence of mass graves. So it's a very grim picture that she paints amid the hope that this new country is viable. It's got oil, but it's got a lot of problems. And its future is by no means certain. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program's available at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.